If the walls of your house could speak, what would they say? I'm sure you've all heard that question at some point or another in time, in different situations and different times, talking about different things. But from a spiritual standpoint, from a standpoint of your family's spiritual health, if the walls of our houses could speak, what would they say? Would they tell a story of laughter and joy, or would they tell a story of conflict and frustration and anger? That's a question I want you to think about tonight, and I'll repeat it a couple of times as we go through the discussion tonight. There's a book that's out right now. It's called The Story. The Story is basically a book that was written to answer or to deal with some of the excuses that people make as to why they aren't interested in the Bible. Many people say the Bible is too difficult, too challenging to read, that the Bible is hard to understand, that it doesn't apply to their lives. And so there's lots of excuses people make for why they do not have any interest in reading the Bible. And so this book was written using verses from Genesis through Revelation. And with each verse or with each text that they took, they wrote a chapter talking about that. And throughout the story, it connects man from Adam and Eve until John's revelation. And we get to see the connection throughout that time. Everything about the book is not what I would say is a good book or a good read, but there's a lot of really good information in there. And they take a lot of interesting accounts that we kind of forget sometimes and look into them and talk about them and show how amazing God was and God is, and that he could take a man from a humble beginning, from an average home, from a rough life, and make him one of the heroes of faith that we look up to today. Make him someone powerful, someone mighty that we look at today and say, what a great man. And we sometimes forget the life that they came out of to become that great man. And this morning we talked about Naomi and Ruth and Boaz and Obed. And tonight I want to look a little bit earlier. I want to look at David. Now, I know there's lots of lessons on David. I know it's not a new subject, a new topic, something you hadn't heard before. But I want to look at a specific moment in his life. And so, if you will, just stick with me for a little while. I want to talk about some of the things, some of the stories we know about him, and then how they connect back to this one moment that may have been a turning point in David's life. If you've ever sat down and read through the story of David, from the time he slayed the giant until the time of his death, it's a very up and down life. It's a very difficult life at times. There's great heights and there's great depths. And you look at it and you think, that's not the normal fairy tale story. I think a lot of times we tend to look at it from the perspective we teach it to children, and it's King David and his power and his might and how great and wonderful he was, and he slayed the giant. We forget sometimes about the harder times and the more difficult days and the darker moments in his life. And if you really go through the whole thing, you realize that his life was probably not always that of a fairy tale. It probably didn't always feel like a happily ever after kind of life. In fact, there were a lot of moments in his life where it looked a lot more like a soap opera than a children's story. And as you read through it and you look at it, you begin to ask yourself questions. You begin to think, is this really the man after God's own heart? Is that really what they refer to this man as? Is this really who he is? I mean, as you consider some of the things that he did and that he had within his family. And so tonight, I want to look at his family life. And I want us to think about our own family life. Think about our home life, and this goes from any angle. It can be from husband to wife, from parent to child, or from siblings, or from children up to parents. And consider that relationship and that conversation and that lifestyle you live. And as we talk about David's family, consider how he compares and contrasts to our own. And if the walls of our house could talk, if the walls of our home could speak, would we be comfortable with the story they tell to others? You know, on our wedding day, we stand before our spouse and we make commitments. We say, for better, for worse, for richer or poorer, till death do us part. And we mean that. We really mean that. When we're sitting up to saying those words, it's coming from our heart. It's something we've thought about. Hopefully, it's something we've really put some time into and energy into, understanding exactly what it means to devote ourselves to that relationship. But then something unexpected happens in that story. We didn't know that it wasn't always going to be a honeymoon. We didn't realize that there were going to be times when we didn't like each other as much as we did on our wedding day. We didn't like each other as much as we did when we were dating. We didn't realize there were going to be times when stubborn characteristics that we saw in the other's parents began to appear in our spouse. We begin to realize they're not as perfect as I thought they were. I know that goes both ways. Probably so, sometimes more so from one angle to the other. I'll let you guys decide which direction that is. But we have these moments when we ask ourselves, what did I get into? And it's not something we're saying, I'm not ready for this, I want out. It's just a question of confusion. A question where we sit there and say, this is not exactly what I thought it was going to be. This is not exactly what I was expecting. What exactly have I gotten myself into? And it's a legitimate question because we legitimately don't always know what's going on. And we begin to have things come up and things that happen. And we begin to see different things that kind of make us question things and worry maybe at times. And really start to think about what we're doing and how we're living and what's going on in our life. And so we turn from times of life where we begin that marriage as just being a happy, loving couple where everything's just hunky-dory to sometimes it just feels like your business partners, doesn't it? Sometimes it feels like we're just giving out responsibilities to each other. We're just giving each other things that need to be done. We're just going through a checklist. On Sunday night, we sit down and say, okay, you take care of this, and you get this one here, and you take that kid there, and I'll make sure this is done. And it feels like we're running a business sometimes instead of a home. And I understand that's how it goes as life goes on and things get busy, but I wonder if sometimes we forget to make it a home first. Do we allow that mentality to overtake that it does become that mentality of a business? And so if our walls spoke, would it be a very sterile speech of communication that's only about getting things done and completing tasks that have to be done and just getting through the week? Would it be a talk that sounds like it came out of a conference room rather than the living room of our homes? My guess is that if you asked David if he would have imagined the story his walls would tell, he would have said no. Because the story from David's family is at times a tragedy. Is at times a train wreck. And it's one of those situations where you look at it and you think, man, I can't imagine. I thought things were tough in my home sometimes. I thought we had difficult moments at our house. I can't imagine going through some of the things that David and his family dealt with. And so I was reading that book, The Story, and in chapter 12 of that story, it talks about David. And it begins with this quote from Scripture. It says, in the spring when the kings were off at war. Now we know that quote because that is the beginning of a perilous time, a difficult time, a time that really just turns David's world upside down in his life. As the other kings were off at war, fighting the wars that they were fought at, David, the king himself, should have been there, but for some reason was not. He stayed back behind. He stayed at home. I'm not sure the reason. I'm not sure we even give him one, but he didn't go out while everyone else was there. And so he stays at home, and you know the story. He's out one night. He's up late maybe, and he goes up on the roof, and he sees Bathsheba, and he calls for Bathsheba to be brought over to him, and the affair begins. Before long, she's found with child, and he tries to bring Uriah the Hittite, her husband, home and try to cover up his sin. But Uriah, being the loyal man of the army he is, he's not going to go in and see his wife and have a relationship with his wife when all his men are out at war. So he just refuses to do so. He stands up and is a loyal man to his troops. And so David sends him back with a letter to the commander. And have you ever thought about how sick that is? That he sent Uriah back carrying his own death warrant in his hand? He sent him back with this letter, and the idea was to send Uriah out on the front line and withdraw back and just let Uriah be killed by the other armies and just pretend like it was just one of those casualties of war. That was David's plan. That was David's plan. He had the affair first, then he tried to cover it up, then he tried to figure out a way to make sure it didn't get back to anyone else, and so in order to do that, he went to murder. The man after God's own heart. Affair, cover up, and murder, just like that. And it's one of those things where you look at and you think, as I read that story, it looks at me and I say, how could you ever do that? When you think about it, maybe not on that same level, but on a lower level, David was just trying to cover things up. He was just trying to make his family look better than it was. Do you think we're ever guilty of that? How many of you ever had that experience? I remember when I was a kid, it didn't happen often, but I remember being a kid, coming to church in the car. Mom and Dad are fussing about something the whole way there. I'm in the back seat hitting my sister. She's screaming at Mama, and I'm getting in trouble for that. We're fussing the whole way. You walk in the back door, and all of a sudden that switch goes on, and everybody just smiles, and everybody looks happy as they can be. You guys ever done that? I know you have. We all have, okay? Because we all have problems. But we don't like to share that with other people, do we? We like to make sure that our brothers and sisters in Christ think that we have it all together just like they do. The funny thing is they don't have it all together either. They've got problems too, but we feel that need to present ourselves in a certain way to others. And I'm thankful we do, because I don't want everybody coming in screaming and yelling at their kids and fighting with each other all day during church. But to a certain level, that becomes more important to us than actually overcoming the trials that are dividing our home. It becomes more important or more acceptable for us just to say, well, we'll just put on a good front, pretend like it never happened. We'll just go in there and smile and make sure everything looks good and pretend like there's no problems. And then we actually forget to ever actually do anything with the problem. The problem just gets put in the back burner, and it doesn't go away, because we know things that are unresolved don't just disappear. It just goes back into the list with the other things we've put away, and it gets pretty rough. And you look at David's life and you say, well, that's a pretty messy life he's got going on there. Sounds like the plot off the original soap opera. This idea of stealing another man's wife and then trying to cover it up and then killing that man just sounds like a story out of a soap opera. And then you keep reading and you find out there's Amnon, one of David's sons, who rapes his half-sister Tamar. And then Tamar's full brother comes out, Absalom, and he plans and plots for years to revenge his sister's rape, and then he kills Amnon. And then there's a civil war between Absalom and David, the fighting over the kingdom, and eventually Absalom, his other son, loses his life. Affair, lies and deceit and cover-up, murder, rape, murder, death. This is his family's life. This is his timeline of his life with his children. And I think as I look at that and as I read that and I think about how is it even possible that someone could go through all of that? How did his family become such a mess? How did it fall apart like that? And I think you find the answer by going back in the story. Going back a little bit earlier. Going back and seeing what it was that maybe began the unraveling for David in this part of his life. And that's what I want us to do tonight. I want us to go back and to look at an event that takes place in his life. And it doesn't maybe necessarily appear to be a big event. But I think as we look into it, you see that it actually does have quite an impact on his future and on his family and all the things that he goes through that we just talked about later on in his life. And I think there's value in it for us to go back and look at that. Because what we're going to look at tonight seems like a small, insignificant moment in his life. But I believe it's those small, insignificant moments in our life, those small, everyday decisions that we make that can affect important future events in our lifetime. We don't see it. We don't know it now. But eventually some, if not many, of the choices we make today will come into play in the future moments and events in our lives. So you got a Bible with you tonight. I hope you do. Turn over to 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel chapter 6, we're going to read for just a few verses from here tonight. I think one of the reasons it's helpful when I hear stories of families torn apart, of destroyed relationships, to look at is this story right here, because oftentimes, stories of families falling apart and marriages that are ending and relationships between parents and child being severed, when you hear that story, that usually ends with that conclusion, everything's falling apart. Everything's just falling apart. And you know like I do, when you get to that point where you feel like everything is just falling apart, you feel like you can't catch the pieces quick enough. You feel like it's too late and it's just all come apart and there's nothing you can do yet. And you watch these episodes on TV of these shows of people whose lives have fallen apart, and the question's always asked, how did this happen? How did you get to this point where everything just fell apart? And so often the answer they give is something like, I don't know how it happened. I don't know what happened. I thought everything was okay. And then I thought we were getting along great, and then she... dot, dot, dot. I thought things were going well. I thought we really were connecting, and then he... dot, dot, dot. See, a lot of times we look at the situation and we say, I don't know how it got here. And the reason we don't know how it got to the point it's at is because we weren't aware of the small decisions we were making along the way that we were building up and leading to that situation in our life. It could be divorce. It could be a relationship between a child and a parent. It could be a relationship at work. It could be a relationship between friends. There's so many different relationships that end just on an explosion all of a sudden. And you look back and people sit down and say, how'd that happen? They say, I don't know. It just did. It just all fell apart. It didn't just all fall apart. There was something in the background that brought it to that point. And I think we see kind of the background in David's life here tonight that got him to that point where it all just kind of fell apart. So in 2 Samuel chapter 6, We see a scene that I think if it had played out differently, it would have changed the rest of the story. It would have changed the course of David's life. David is married to his first wife, Michal, and this is the wife of his youth. And the beginning of their relationship was out of a fairy tale. It was a romantic beginning. David was just a young man when he went to the battlefield to take his brother's food and supplies. And they're sitting there being taunted by Goliath. And we know that story. David goes up there and he sees Goliath taunting them, and he's had enough of it. So he decides he'll take care of Goliath. Well, one of the details we leave out of that story a lot of times is the fact that Saul had made a promise or a commitment to any man who was willing to go fight Goliath. Any man who would fight Goliath, he would give them riches and his daughter's hand in marriage if they won. And so David goes up here, he fights Goliath, he slays the giant, and he's given these things by Saul. He's given his daughter's hand in marriage, although it takes a while to get it if you read the story. But eventually he gets his bride and Michal, and they're married, and they start off in this relationship, and it seems like a good little story there to begin with, and it seems like things are going to go all right. And by the time you get to 2 Samuel 6, it looks like David's on top of the world. Things have gone well for him as he's a leader of the people. He's the king, and the offices are good, and the nation of Israel is in good season, and the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Lord, has entered into the city. It's returned, and there's this great celebration going on. And in the midst of this great celebration, as they get too excited and they begin to celebrate this great moment in their life, they begin to celebrate and worship God, and David is leading this charge and leading this worship. And in the midst of the celebration, he unrobes himself and begins dancing among all the people and having a good time while Michael's back at home. And Michal, somewhere in the distance, is seeing what's happening, and she's not too fond of it. She's not real happy with the way that David is acting at this moment. And so David comes home. And when David gets home, Michael's not a happy wife. Michael's not in a good mood. And so he enters into the house, and as soon as he enters in verse 20, it tells him David returned to bless his household. Basically, what it's saying right there is that David was coming home in a good mood. He finished a good day at work. Things were going well. He comes in, and he's smiling, and he's excited to be home and say hi and hug and kiss his wife. But Michael's not quite in that same mood. She comes out to meet David. She meets him at the door. She's upset. She's frustrated. And she talks to him. And she begins to berate him. You can hear the sarcasm in her voice. She says, "How the king of Israel honored himself today, uncovering himself today before the eyes of his servants, female servants, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." She comes home, or David comes home. He's in a good mood. Things are going well. They're celebrating. And as soon as he walks in the door, his wife meets him, and she is not excited about him being home. She is not happy, and she lights into him. She tells him, "What are you doing? What were you thinking? How could you do that out there in front of all these people like you're one of the other vulgar people, like you're one of the other servants? Why are you out there acting like this while I'm at home?" And so Michal attacks David, and David gets defensive. That happens often, doesn't it? We get defensive when someone attacks us. And so David becomes defensive back at her. And he says, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and all his house." That's right. David goes for the father-in-law card right there. Now, that's a common play, right? That's something we do, and it always works really well, right? No, that's not a good idea, right? This is not a new trick. It's been all around for a long time. David says, "God chose me above your father to be the king. I think I'm pretty smart. I think I'm pretty sharp. I think I know what I'm doing. God chose me. God appointed me. God made me the king. Not your dad, not your father anymore, but it was me." He goes on there and he keeps talking to her. He says, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will celebrate before the Lord." Now, I think, as I've tried to read some more and read the context and do some study, I think this was a legitimate moment of worship and praise on David's behalf. I believe he was doing something to praise God. I believe this was a moment of celebration. I do not think it was a negative moment he was having. I don't think it was a moment when he was not thinking clearly. I think he was thinking clearly. I think he was doing what he thought was right, and I think he was doing things according to the way they were expected of him. But Michal was at home, and she didn't like what was going on. She didn't like what she saw at that moment. And so they have this blow up, this argument, right when they walk in the door. And the chapter just ends with a simple statement. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. That simple statement carries a lot of weight. Because what's that saying is after that point, they were no more. He threw her off to the side. They had no more relationship. What an amazing turn of events. David's out celebrating, excited. The ark's back. Things are going well. And just like that, things are going in a 180 degrees the other direction. I think that's an interesting story to look at, and I think it's an interesting story to really decide to go back and dissect and think about it here. What if David had played that differently? What if David had included his wife in that celebration? What if Michal had said, when David came in, "I'm really proud of you. You're doing a great job, but I'd like to talk to you." What if David, when he was approached by Michal, said, "You know what? I didn't think about that. I'm sorry. Let's talk about it." What if in that moment, one or the other, if not both, had showed some calm and some resolve and said, "Let's talk about this. Let's figure this out. I think it would have made a big difference in the way David's life with his family from that point on went forward. I think it would have made a big difference because I'm pretty sure if they had sat down and talked it out, it wouldn't have ended so abruptly like it did at that point in time. And I'm convinced that the story of our families are written in these seemingly insignificant moments of life. In these moments that we look at and don't think twice about. These little moments add up. And we get to decide what direction they're adding into. Am I giving my spouse the love they deserve in little doses along the way? Am I showing my parents the respect they deserve with the little things I do along the way? Am I showing my friends, my brothers and sisters in Christ, that they really matter to me in the small steps I take along the way in my journey? Or am I showing all of those people that I really don't care when the small decisions I make are selfish and all about me? We get to decide. We get to choose how we're going to react in moments like that. We see the big moments and we think, well, for David's family, it was obviously Bathsheba where everything went downhill. It was obviously the affair that led to the downhill, fall and demise of his family. Well, I don't think so when you look back and see these small moments that changed the course of his family. When you go back and see the way things happened before we ever got to Bathsheba, I think it's important that we look at these little moments and think long and hard about what's going on in the small moments. A few years ago, when I was in high school, we lived in Mississippi, and we had an ice storm. I'd never seen an ice storm before, but we had an ice storm. And after the storm had, after everything had been established, or everything had frozen that night, we went out the next day and began riding around, and there were some trees that had fallen on a neighbor's house. And that night, after it had gotten all the icy and everything, the wind had come and blown a lot of it over, and it had fallen all over the house. And so we go up there, still from church, and there's a man there cutting down the trees and taking them off the house. And I didn't really think twice about this. In fact, I didn't even think about it again until Dad said something a couple of weeks ago when I was talking to him. We were talking about my granddad, and but he said we walked up there and he said, "That must have been some storm to take out that tree." And the guy cutting down said, "No, it wasn't that storm that took out that tree." And he took us up there and showed us where that tree had been rotting for a long time. And he said it was just that storm that finally knocked it over, but it had been taken out a long time ago. I think that's how it is a lot of times in our lives. I think that reflects on how our relationships work. We see the storm that came through. We see the aftermath of it. And we say, well, there's the cause. Well, it probably wasn't the cause. It was probably something going on for a long time before that, before we ever got to that point. And that storm was just what finally blew it over. And so what we see, I think, in chapter 6 are some helpful lessons in teaching us how to deal with the day in and day out conflict that oftentimes leads to a tree falling in our lives, leads to a relationship falling or a hurt in our lives. I think we see some things that go on here, and forgive me if this sounds like a Jerry Barber lesson because I'm talking about relationships and talking to people, but I think it's a little bit different angle, and I don't think I'll ever get mad if you're talking about Jerry Barber lessons. So I'm going to give you a four-pointer tonight, and I'm going to be a little bit quicker than I was this morning. First thing we need to do when we realize there's conflict in our relationships. When conflict arises, this is straight out of Jerry's book. This is not something I came up with on my own right here. The rest of it I did. Identify the base issue. Identify the root of the problem. Michael lays into David as soon as he walks in the door. As soon as he comes home, she attacks him, mad, upset, frustrated about what's going on. Maybe it would have been different, the final outcome, if David had listened. And maybe David would have realized her frustration and her aggravation wasn't so much at what he was doing at that moment, but maybe there was something deeper to it than that. Maybe there was more to it than just what was on the surface. Maybe he was seeing a symptom of a bigger problem that was below the surface. I think it's something that we need to think about in our relationships. A lot of times, especially getting to work with teenagers and being a little bit older now and getting to look at the way things go and listening to what they have to say about one another, I see that a lot of times their arguments, their disagreements, and you guys might agree with me on this, are over things that aren't even really issues. They're just what came to the surface at that moment and began that argument. See, deep down below, there was something brewing there a long time. There was something really cooking down there. And finally, something bubbled up at the surface that they could both hit on, and they attacked. And I think a lot of times we look at teenagers and say, oh, that's just kids. They're just kids. They fight over little stupid things like that. They fight over little dumb issues. They'll get over it. But they don't. They get mad at each other. They get frustrated with one another. And you know what's ironic about that is we're sitting there passing off what they do as childish and immature, when a lot of times we do the exact same thing. We ignore the real issues, and we fight over the little things that bubble up on the surface. They're not small issues. They're not small things. And if they go unattended, they become bigger issues and bigger problems that can change the outcome of our family. When conflict arises, identify the base issue. Find out what's going on. Find out what's really causing the problems. Number two, find the right time and place. I'm going to suggest that when somebody comes home excited from the day, or someone comes home mad from the day, it's probably not the right time to have an argument about something they did. It's probably not the right time to bring up a very difficult, stressful issue. You know, there are certain times in life where it's nice to just be able to sit back and relax, isn't it? It's nice to just sit back and think about good things and have a good talk. And I read something this last week when I was doing some research. It said, while we're on the road driving, when we're eating at the table, and when we're in the living rooms of family, these are places to encourage and to build up the family relationships. Instead, they often turn into boardroom meetings where we attack one another and imagine throwing the other out a window. Now, I hope you're not throwing anyone out windows, but you understand what he's saying right there. We take these moments that should be good, positive family time, and a lot of times they become argument time. The child's mad at the parent for something that happened that day, or it's been going on, so they go off on the parent. The husband and wife are arguing over something. Maybe the wife didn't cook the right thing, or burnt dinner, or maybe the husband didn't get the oil changed in the car or something, and they start arguing back and forth. And what should be a positive, good family time becomes a time when nobody wants to be there. I have a feeling one of the reasons that we had this push to get back to dinner time today is because there was a reason people got away from dinner time. It obviously wasn't very enjoyable. If it was, people would still do it. People do things they like to do. And I think we can get back to that and find the right times, other times when it's a good opportunity to talk things out and not waste the opportunities we have to have a good time to build relationships and to build one another up, especially after a stressful day, especially after tough times. Number three, stick to the issue. When the problems arise, stick to the issue. David goes to the standby. He attacks the in-laws. Your father, your dad. I love my in-laws. I love them. And I've only made the mistake one time of saying, you're acting like your mom. She didn't touch me. She didn't say a word for a while. But the look on her face told me that was a horrible choice of arguments to make. That was a horrible idea to say that right then. And so I really try not to use that one ever again. That image is in my head and it won't go away. I understand why we have those feelings though. Because we realize that the other person is skirting the issue. When we start grasping at straws, when we start looking for anything else to talk about besides what's really there, I think what we're telling the other person, the other party, is that you're not important enough for me to be honest with you. You're not important enough for me to tell you what I really think about this issue. You're not important enough for me to be honest about how I feel and about who I am and what I've done. I think one of the greatest things we can do for one another is just to be honest with each other. There's a way to be honest. There's a positive way to be honest, and that's what number four comes in. Start positive. Start positive. You know, there's not a worse feeling in the world than walking into a room and the first thing someone says to you is, I need to talk to you right now. My dad used to do it when I was a kid, and it scared me to death. Sometimes even as an adult, it still makes me uncomfortable when someone says, I need to talk to you right now. That bothers me. That scares me. That makes me on guard right off the bat. When you fly in the door and your wife or your husband meets you, and they've got that look in their eye, and they said, I need to talk to you right now. Do you think it's going to go real well? Probably not. I think when Michael met David at the door, angry and upset, it set up a stage for a fight. It set up a situation where things were not going to go well. And I think a lot of times in our life, we make that mistake. We forget that we are lucky. We are blessed to have a spouse, a family, a father, a mother, a son, a daughter, Christian brothers and sisters. We forget how fortunate we are to have that every single day. We forget that at one point, that meant all to us. And sometimes we forget how great it is to have that around us. And so we begin to argue and begin to fight and become defensive because instead of being positive, instead of trying to look at the good in the situation, we look at the negative in every place. The writer of Proverbs said, it's better to live in a desert than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. You think about what that's saying right there? It's saying it's better if your wife is nagging, and wives, you can say if your husband's bugging you too, we'll go both ways on it. I think Solomon's okay with that. If your wife is a quarrelsome person, if the person you're in a relationship with only wants to fuss and fight all the time, you're better off just to go out into the hot desert under the blazing sun, put up a tent, and live a miserable life because it'll be better than the life you'll have if you keep that relationship going with someone who wants to do nothing but argue and fuss all the time. We read through Proverbs in our staff meetings a while back before Jerry left, and it was amazing to me how many times in that book a sentence started off, a verse started off with, it's better to live in a, or it's better to be on a blank than to be in a home with a quarrelsome wife. Now, Solomon had lots of wives and lots of other women, so I understand where Solomon's coming from probably, but it applies to us today too. We don't want to be that kind of person that makes others want to avoid us at all costs, especially if we're going to be children of God who are fulfilling the Great Commission and seeking and saving those who are around us who are lost. The writer of Proverbs also said, nagging and criticism is like a constant dripping. It's that constant drip, 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 drip. We're using torture methods when we go to each other and nag and complain and fuss at each other all the time. And the more we do it, the harder it becomes to overcome the difficulty that we put between ourselves and others. I think it's something that we have to consider on a regular basis. That we have to look at this moment and see Michael coming out to David, meeting him when he comes in from his celebration, and she's critical, and she's sarcastic, and she's negative, and she is bitter. But what would have happened if David had just sat there and listened to what she had to say and apologized? Imagine the difference in the story of David that could have most likely, possibly at least, come out of that one moment being different. You see, it's those little moments in life that shape our future. It's those little things that may seem insignificant at the time that become such a huge part of who we are. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, tells us to love our wives the way that Christ loved the church. Love your wives as Christ loved the church. How did Christ love the church? Well, he loved the church by reconciling himself to her. We need to be the reconciler. We need to be reconciling our relationships. Reconciler is one who goes to the other, the one who pursues after the other, after fixing the problem. To be like Christ is to be the one who sees opportunity and says, I want to make things better, not worse. And so I'm going to do everything I can to improve the relationship rather than make it worse. And so the question tonight is, are you happy with the story that your walls would tell if they could talk? Some of us might be, and that's great. Keep it up. You're doing something right. And teach others. Show them how to do it. Invite them into your home. Let them see what it's like to be in a loving, joyful, Christ-like home. We need that example. But some of us might not be happy with the story ours would tell. We might be ashamed of it. We might be embarrassed by the things that our house could tell others. The great thing about it is you and I have the power to change that tonight. We have the ability to change that story. We have the ability to write over, to paint over that bad story that's on those walls and to begin putting a new one out there. You see, David, despite all we talked about tonight, truly was a man after God's own heart. He was a powerful man. He was a great man. And I'll reference a verse I referenced this morning, Matthew chapter 1. It begins talking about Jesus Christ. He is finally introduced to the world. It is his first time of mentioning it's Jesus as the child, the baby. This is the big moment. And Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1 introduces him as the son of David. Folks, only God could take a man who went through so much in his life, who made mistakes, and allow him to be that example for you and I today. And allow him to be in the lineage of a Savior in Jesus Christ. If you're here tonight and your story is not what you want it to be, you can change it tonight. You can make it better. If you'd like to do something different, do it. If you need to become a child of God because you haven't made a decision yet, why not? Why wait any longer? If you're already one but you've had some issues, some problems in life, and you need to change things, let us help you tonight. Whatever we can do to make things better, won't you let us know as we stand and as we sing.